Chapter 1. The Psychology of Evil: Situated Character Transformations. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. John Milton, Paradise Lost. Look at the painting Circle Limit 4 by the artist M.C. Escher. Now close your eyes and conjure it in your memory. Does your mind's eye see the many white angels dancing about the dark heavens? Or do you see the many black demons, horned devils inhabiting the bright white space of hell? In this illusion by the artist M.C. Escher, both perspectives are equally possible. Once aware of the congruence between good and evil, you cannot see only one and not the other. In what follows, I will not allow you to drift back to the comfortable separation of your good and faultless side from their evil and wicked side. Am I capable of evil? Is the question that I want you to consider over and over again as we journey together to alien environments. Three psychological truths emerge from Escher's image. First, the world is filled with both good and evil. Was, is, will always be. Second, the barrier between good and evil is permeable and nebulous. And third, it is possible for angels to become devils and, perhaps more difficult to conceive, for devils to become angels. Perhaps this image reminds you of the ultimate transformation of good into evil, the metamorphosis of Lucifer into Satan. Lucifer, the light-bearer, was God's favorite angel until he challenged God's authority and was cast into hell along with his band of fallen angels. "Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven," boasts Satan, the adversary of God in Milton's Paradise Lost. In hell, Lucifer, Satan, becomes a liar, an empty impostor who uses boasts, spears, trumpets, and banners, as some national leaders do today. At the demonic conference in hell, of all the major demons, Satan is assured that he cannot regain heaven in any direct confrontation. However, Satan's statesman, Beelzebub, comes up with the most evil of solutions in proposing to avenge themselves against God by corrupting God's greatest creation, humankind. Though Satan succeeds in tempting Adam and Eve to disobey God and be led into evil, God decrees that they will in time be saved. However, for the rest of time, Satan will be allowed to slither around that injunction, enlisting witches to tempt people to evil. Satan's intermediaries would thereafter become the target of zealous inquisitors who want to rid the world of evil, but their horrific methods would breed a new form of systemic evil the world had never before known. Lucifer's sin is what thinkers in the Middle Ages called cupiditas. Cupiditas in English is cupidity, which means avarice, greed, the strong desire for wealth or power over another. What cupiditas means is the desire to turn into oneself or take into oneself everything that is other than self. For instance, lust and rape are forms of cupiditas because they entail using another person as a thing to gratify one's own desire. Murder for profit is also cupiditas. It is the opposite of the concept of caritas, which means envisioning oneself as part of a ring of love in which each individual self has worth in itself, but also as it relates to every other self. "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you" is a weak expression of caritas. The Latin caritas et amor, dies ibi est, is probably the best expression of the concept. Wherever caritas and love are, God is. For Dante, the sins that spring from that root are the most extreme sins of the wolf, the spiritual condition of having an inner black hole so deep within oneself that no amount of power or money can ever fill it. For those suffering the mortal malady called cupiditas, whatever exists outside of oneself has worth only as it can be exploited by or taken into oneself. In Dante's hell, those guilty of that sin are in the ninth circle, frozen in the lake of ice. Having cared for nothing but self in life, they are encased in I see self for eternity. By making people focus only on oneself in this way, Satan and his followers turn their eyes away from the harmony of love that unites all living creatures. The sins of the wolf cause a human being to turn away from grace and to make self his only good, and also his prison. In the ninth circle of the inferno, the sinners, possessed of the spirit of the insatiable wolf, are frozen in a self-imposed prison, where prisoner and guard are fused in an egocentric reality. In her scholarly search for the origins of Satan, the historian Elaine Pagels offers a provocative thesis on the psychological significance of Satan as humanity's mirror. What fascinates us about Satan is the way he expresses qualities that go beyond what we ordinarily recognize as human. Satan evokes more than the greed, envy, lust, and anger we identify with our own worst impulses, and more than what we call brutality, which imputes to human beings a resemblance to animals, brutes. Evil, then, at its worst, seems to involve the supernatural, what we recognize with a shudder as the diabolic inverse of Martin Buber's characterization of God as wholly other. We fear evil, but are fascinated by it. We create myths of evil conspiracies and come to believe them enough to mobilize forces against them. We reject the other as different and dangerous because it's unknown, yet we are thrilled by contemplating sexual excess and violations of moral codes by those who are not our kind. Professor of Religious Studies, David Frankfurter, concludes his search for evil incarnate by focusing on the social construction of this evil other. The construction of the social other as cannibal savage, demon, sorcerer, vampire, or an amalgam of them all draws upon a consistent repertoire of symbols of inversion. The stories we tell about people out on the periphery play with their savagery, libertine customs, and monstrosity. At the same time, the combined horror and pleasure we derive from contemplating this otherness, sentiments that influence the brutality of colonists, missionaries, and armies entering the lands of those others, certainly affect us at the level of individual fantasy as well. Transformations, angels, devils, and the rest of us mere mortals. The Lucifer effect is my attempt to understand the processes of transformation at work when good or ordinary people do bad or evil things. We will deal with the fundamental question, what makes people go wrong? But instead of resorting to a traditional religious dualism of good versus evil, of wholesome nature versus corrupting nurture, we will look at real people engaged in life's daily tasks, enmeshed in doing their jobs, surviving within an often turbulent crucible of human nature. We will seek to understand the nature of their character transformations when they are faced with powerful situational forces. Let's begin with a definition of evil. Mine is a simple, psychologically based one. Evil consists in intentionally behaving in ways that harm, abuse, demean, dehumanize, or destroy innocent others, or using one's authority and systemic power to encourage or permit others to do so on your behalf. In short, as my friend and mentor Irving Sarnoff says in his aphorism, evil is knowing better, but doing worse. What makes human behavior work? What determines human thought and action? What makes some of us lead moral, righteous lives, while others seem to slip easily into immorality and crime? Is what we think about human nature based on the assumption that inner determinants guide us up the good paths or down the bad ones? Do we give insufficient attention to the outer determinants of our thoughts, feelings, and actions? To what extent are we creatures of the situation, of the moment, of the mob? And is there anything that anyone has ever done that you are absolutely certain you could never be compelled to do? Most of us hide behind egocentric biases that generate the illusion that we are special. These self-serving, protective shields allow us to believe that each of us is above average on any test of self-integrity. Too often we look to the stars through the thick lens of personal invulnerability when we should also look down to the slippery slope beneath our feet. Such egocentric biases are more commonly found in societies that foster independent orientations, such as Euro-American cultures, and less so in collectivist-oriented societies, such as in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. In the course of our voyage through good and evil, I will ask you to reflect upon three issues. How well do you really know yourself, your strengths and weaknesses? Does your self-knowledge come from reviewing your behavior in familiar situations, or from being exposed to totally new settings where your old habits are challenged? In the same vein, how well do you really know the people with whom you interact daily, your family, friends, co-workers, and lover? One thesis of this book is that most of us know ourselves only from our limited experiences in familiar situations that involve rules, laws, policies, and pressures that constrain us. We go to school, to work, on vacation, to parties. We pay the bills and the taxes day in and year out. But what happens when we are exposed to totally new and unfamiliar settings where our habits don't suffice? You start a new job, go on your first computer-matched date, join a fraternity, get arrested, enlist in the military, join a cult, or volunteer for an experiment. The old you might not work as expected when the ground rules change. Throughout our journey, I would like you to continually ask the "me also" question as we encounter various forms of evil. We will examine genocide in Rwanda, the mass suicide and murder of People's Temple followers in the jungles of Guyana, the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, the horrors of Nazi concentration camps, the torture by military and civilian police around the world, and the sexual abuse of parishioners by Catholic priests, and search for lines of continuity between the scandalous, fraudulent behavior of executives at Enron and WorldCom corporations. Finally, we will see how some common threads in all these evils run through the recently uncovered abuses of civilian prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. One especially significant thread tying these atrocities together will come out of a body of research in experimental social psychology, particularly a study that has come to be known as the Stanford Prison Experiment. Evil. Fixed and within, or mutable and without? The idea that an unbridgeable chasm separates good people from bad people is a source of comfort for at least two reasons. First, it creates a binary logic in which evil is essentialized. Most of us perceive evil as an entity, a quality that is inherent in some people and not in others. Bad seeds ultimately produce bad fruits as their destinies unfold. We define evil by pointing to the really bad tyrants in our era, such as Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, Idi Amin, Saddam Hussein, and other political leaders who have orchestrated mass murders. We must also acknowledge the more ordinary, lesser evils of drug dealers, rapists, sex trade traffickers, perpetrators of fraudulent scams on the elderly, and those whose bullying destroys the well-being of our children. Upholding a good-evil dichotomy also takes good people off the responsibility hook. They are freed from even considering their possible role in creating, sustaining, perpetuating, or conceding to the conditions that contribute to delinquency, crime, vandalism, teasing, bullying, rape, torture, terror, and violence. It's the way of the world, and there's not much that can be done to change it, certainly not by me. An alternative conception treats evil in incrementalist terms, as something of which we are all capable, depending on circumstances. People may at any time possess a particular attribute, say intelligence, pride, honesty, or evil, to a greater or lesser degree. Our nature can be changed, whether toward the good or the bad side of human nature. The incrementalist view implies an acquisition of qualities through experience or concentrated practice, or by means of an external intervention, such as being offered a special opportunity. In short, we can learn to become good or evil, regardless of our genetic inheritance, personality, or family legacy. Alternative understandings, dispositional, situational, and systemic. Running parallel to this pairing of essentialist and incremental conceptions is the contrast between dispositional and situational causes of behavior. When faced with some unusual behavior, some unexpected event, some anomaly that doesn't make sense, how do we go about trying to understand it? The traditional approach has been to identify inherent personal qualities that lead to the action, genetic makeup, personality traits, character, free will, and other dispositions. Given violent behavior, one searches for sadistic personality traits. Given heroic deeds, the search is on for genes that predispose toward altruism. In the United States, a rash of shootings in which high school students murder and wound scores of other students and teachers rocks suburban communities. In England, a pair of 10-year-old boys kidnap 2-year-old Jamie Bulger from a shopping center and brutally murder him in cold blood. In Palestine and Iraq, young men and women become suicide bombers. In most European countries during World War II, many people protected Jews from capture by the Nazis, even though they knew that if they were caught, they and their families would be killed. In many countries, whistleblowers risk personal loss by exposing injustice and immoral actions of superiors. Why? The traditional view, among those who come from cultures that emphasize individualism, is to look within for answers, for pathology or heroism. Modern psychiatry is dispositionally oriented. So are clinical psychology and personality and assessment psychology. Most of our institutions are founded on such a perspective, including law, medicine, and religion. Culpability, illness, and sin, they assume, are to be found within the guilty party, the sick person, and the sinner. They begin their quest for understanding with the who questions. Who is responsible? Who caused it? Who gets the blame, and who gets the credit? Social psychologists, such as myself, tend to avoid this rush to dispositional judgment when trying to understand the causes of unusual behaviors. They prefer to begin their search for meaning by asking the what questions. What conditions could be contributing to certain reactions? What circumstances might be involved in generating behavior? What was the situation like from the perspective of the actors? Social psychologists ask, to what extent can an individual's actions be traced to factors outside the actor, to situational variables and environmental processes unique to a given setting? The dispositional approach is to the situational as a medical model of health is to a public health model. A medical model tries to find the source of the illness, disease, or disability within the affected person. By contrast, public health researchers assume that the vectors of disease transmission come from the environment, creating conditions that foster illness. Sometimes the sick person is the end product of environmental pathogens, which, unless counteracted, will affect others, regardless of attempts to improve the health of the individual. For example, in the dispositional approach, a child who exhibits a learning disability may be given a variety of medical and behavioral treatments to overcome that handicap. But in many cases, especially among the poor, the problem is caused by ingesting lead in paint that flakes off the walls of tenement apartments and is worsened by conditions of poverty, the situational approach. These alternative perspectives are not just abstract variations in conceptual analyses, but lead to very different ways of dealing with personal and societal problems. The significance of such analyses extends to all of us who, as intuitive psychologists, go about our daily lives trying to figure out why people do what they do and how they may be changed to do better. But it is the rare person in an individualist culture who is not infected with a dispositional bias, always looking first to motives, traits, genes, and personal pathologies. Most of us have a tendency both to overestimate the importance of dispositional qualities and to underestimate the importance of situational qualities when trying to understand the causes of other people's behavior. In the following chapters, I will offer a substantial body of evidence that counterbalances the dispositional view of the world, and will expand the focus to consider how people's character may be transformed by their being immersed in situations that unleash powerful situational forces. People and situations are usually in a state of dynamic interaction. Although you probably think of yourself as having a consistent personality across time and space, that is likely not to be true. You are not the same person working alone as you are in a group, in a romantic setting versus an educational one, when you are with close friends or in an anonymous crowd, or when you are traveling abroad as when at home base. The Malleus Maleficarum and the Inquisition's WID Program. One of the first documented sources of the widespread use of the dispositional view to understand evil and rid the world of its pernicious influence is found in a text that became the Bible of the Inquisition, the Malleus Maleficarum, or the Witch's Hammer. It was required reading for the Inquisition judges. It begins with a conundrum to be solved. How can evil continue to exist in a world governed by an all-good, all-powerful God? One answer, God allows it as a test of men's souls. Yield to its temptations, go to hell. Resist its temptations and be invited into heaven. However, God restricted the devil's direct influence over people because of his earlier corruption of Adam and Eve. The devil's solution was to have intermediaries do his evil bidding by using witches as his indirect link to people they would corrupt. To reduce the spread of evil in Catholic countries, the proposed solution was to find and eliminate witches. What was required was a means to identify witches, get them to confess to heresy, and then destroy them. The mechanism for witch identification and destruction, which in our times might be known as the WID program, was simple and direct. Find out through spies who among the population were witches, test their witchly natures by getting confessions using various torture techniques, and kill those who failed the test. Although I have made light of what amounted to a carefully designed system of mass terror, torture, and extermination of untold thousands of people, this kind of simplistic reduction of the complex issues regarding evil fueled the fires of the Inquisition. Making witches the despised dispositional category provided a ready solution to the problem of societal evil by simply destroying as many agents of evil as could be identified, tortured, and boiled in oil or burned at the stake. Given that the church and its state alliances were run by men, it is no wonder that women were more likely than men to be labeled as witches. The suspects were usually marginalized or threatening in some way, widowed, poor, ugly, deformed, or in some cases considered too proud and powerful. The terrible paradox of the Inquisition is that the ardent and often sincere desire to combat evil generated evil on a grander scale than the world had ever seen before. It ushered in the use by state and church of torture devices and tactics that were ultimate perversion of any ideal of human perfection. The exquisite nature of the human mind, which can create great works of art, science, and philosophy, was perverted to engage in acts of creative cruelty that were designed to break the will. The tools of the trade of the Inquisition are still on display in various prisons around the world, in military and civilian interrogation centers, where torture is standard operating procedure, as we shall see later in our visit to Abu Ghraib prison. Power systems exert pervasive top-down dominance. My appreciation of the power residing in systems started with an awareness of how institutions create mechanisms that translate ideology, say the causes of evil, into operating procedures, such as the Inquisition's witch hunts. In other words, my focus has widened considerably through a fuller appreciation of the ways in which situational conditions are created and shaped by higher order factors, systems of power. Systems, not just dispositions and situations, must be taken into account in order to understand complex behavior patterns. Aberrant, illegal, or immoral behavior by individuals in service professions, such as policemen, corrections officers, and soldiers, is typically labeled the misdeeds of a few bad apples. The implication is that they are a rare exception and must be set on one side of the impermeable line between evil and good, with the majority of good apples set on the other side. But who is making the distinction? Usually it is the guardians of the system who want to isolate the problem in order to deflect attention and blame away from those at the top who may be responsible for creating untenable working conditions or for a lack of oversight or supervision. Again, the bad apple. Dispositional view ignores the apple barrel and its potentially corrupting situational impact on those within it. A systems analysis focuses on the barrel makers, on those with the power to design the barrel. It is the power elite, the barrel makers, often working behind the scenes, who arrange many of the conditions of life for the rest of us, who must spend time in the variety of institutional settings they have constructed. The sociologist C. Wright Mills has illuminated this black hole of power. The power elite is composed of men whose positions enable them to transcend the ordinary environments of ordinary men and women. They are in positions to make decisions having major consequences. Whether they do or do not make such decisions is less important than the fact that they do occupy such pivotal positions. Their failure to act, their failure to make decisions, is itself an act that is often of greater significance than the decisions they do make. For they are in command of the major hierarchies and organizations of modern society. They rule the big corporations. They run the machinery of state and claim its prerogatives. They direct the military establishment. They occupy strategic command posts of the social structure, in which are now centered the effective means of power and the wealth and celebrity which they enjoy. As the interests of these diverse power brokers coalesce, they come to define our reality in ways that George Orwell prophesied in 1984. The military corporate religious complex is the ultimate megasystem controlling much of the resources and quality of life of many Americans today. It is when power is wedded to chronic fear that it becomes formidable. Eric Hoffer, The Passionate State of Mind. The power to create the enemy. The powerful don't usually do the dirtiest work themselves, just as mafia dons leave the whackings to underlings. Systems create hierarchies of dominance, with influence and communication going down, rarely up, the line. When a power elite wants to destroy an enemy nation, it turns to propaganda experts to fashion a program of hate. What does it take for the citizens of one society to hate the citizens of another society to the degree that they want to segregate them, torment them, even kill them? It requires a hostile imagination, a psychological construction embedded deeply in their minds by propaganda that transforms those others into the enemy. That image is a soldier's most powerful motive, one that loads his rifle with ammunition of hate and fear. The image of a dreaded enemy threatening one's personal well-being and the society's national security emboldens mothers and fathers to send sons to war and empowers governments to rearrange priorities to turn plowshares into swords of destruction. It is all done with words and images. To modify an old adage, sticks and stones may break your bones, but names can sometimes kill you. The process begins with creating stereotyped conceptions of the other, dehumanized perceptions of the other as worthless, the other as all-powerful, the other as demonic, the other as an abstract monster, the other as a fundamental threat to our cherished values and beliefs. With public fear notched up and the enemy threat imminent, reasonable people act irrationally, independent people act in mindless conformity, and peaceful people act as warriors. Dramatic visual images of the enemy on posters, television, magazine covers, movies, and the Internet imprint on the recesses of the limbic system, the primitive brain, with the powerful emotions of fear and hate. The social philosopher Sam Keen brilliantly depicts how this hostile imagination is created by virtually every nation's propaganda on its path to war, and reveals the transformative powers on the human psyche of these images of the enemy. Justifications for the desire to destroy these threats are really afterthoughts, proposed explanations intended for the official record, but not for critical analysis of the damage to be done or being done. The most extreme instance of this hostile imagination at work is, of course, when it leads to genocide, the plan of one people to eliminate from existence all those who are conceptualized as their enemy. We are aware of some of the ways in which Hitler's propaganda machine transformed Jewish neighbors, co-workers, even friends into despised enemies of the state who deserved the final solution. This process was seeded in elementary school textbooks by means of images and texts that rendered all Jews contemptible and not worthy of human compassion. Here I would like to consider briefly a recent example of attempted genocide, along with the use of rape as a weapon against humanity. Then I will show how one aspect of this complex psychological process, the dehumanization component, can be studied in controlled experimental research that isolates its critical features for systematic analysis. Crimes against humanity: genocide, rape, and terror. Literature has taught us for at least 3,000 years that no person or state is incapable of evil. In Homer's account of the Trojan War, Agamemnon, commander of the Greek forces, tells his men before they engage their enemy, "We are not going to leave a single one of the Trojans alive, down to the babies in their mothers' wombs. Not even they must live."